exquisite moment at which he could have ended the life of the man who had so wanted to end his own, and Kathy's, and Sally's, and little Jack yet unborn. Looking in his eyes, and finally seeing the fear at last breaking through the shell of inhumanity. But how many times had he thanked a merciful God that he'd neglected to cock the hammer on his pistol? He would have done it. He'd wanted to do it more than anything in his life, and he could remember pulling the trigger, only to be surprised when it hadn't moved. And then the moment had passed away. Jack could remember killing. The terrorist in London. The one in the boat at the base of his cliff. The cook on the submarine. Surely he'd killed others. That horrible night in Colombia, which had given him nightmares for years after. But Sean Miller was different. It hadn't been necessity for Miller. For him it had been justice of a sort. And he'd been there. And he'd been the law. And God, how he'd wanted to take that worthless life. But he hadn't. The law that had ended the life of that terrorist and his colleagues had been well considered, cold and detached, as it had to be. And for that reason, he had to select the best possible people to repopulate the court, because the decisions they would make were not about one enraged man trying at the same time to protect and avenge his family. They would say what the law was for everyone, and that wasn't about personal desires. This thing people called civilization was about something more than one man's passion. It had to be. And it was his duty to make sure that it was by picking the right people. "Yeah," Martin said, reading the president's face. "Big deal, isn't it?" "Wait a minute." Jack rose and walked out the door to the secretary's room. "Which one of you smokes?" he asked there. "It's me," said Ellen Sumter. She was of Jack's age and probably trying to quit, as all smokers of that age at least claimed. Without another question, she handed her president a Virginia Slim, the same as the crew woman on his airplane, Jack realized, and a butane lighter. The president nodded his thanks and walked back into his office, lighting it. Before he could close the door, Mrs. Sumter raced to follow him with an ashtray taken from her desk drawer. Sitting down, Ryan took a long drag, eyes on the carpet, which was of the great seal of the President of the United States, covered though it was with furniture. "How the hell," Jack asked quietly, "did anybody ever decide that one man could have this much power? I mean, what I'm doing here." "Yes, sir. Kind of like being James Madison, isn't it? You pick the people who decide what the Constitution really means. They're all in their late 40s or 50s, and so they'll be there for a while," Martin told him. "Cheer up. At least it's not a game for you. At least you're doing it the right way. You're not picking women because they're women, or blacks because they're black. I gave you a good mix, color, bathrooms, and everything. But all the names have been redacted out, and you won't be able to tell who's who unless you follow cases, which you probably don't. I give you my word, sir, they're all good ones. I spent a lot of time assembling the list for you. Your guidelines helped, and they were good guidelines. For what it's worth, they're all people who think the way you do. People who like power scare me," the attorney said. "Good ones reflect a lot on what they're doing before they do it. Picking real judges who've made some hard calls. Well, read their decisions. You'll see how hard they worked at what they did." Another puff. He tapped the folders. "I don't know the law well enough to understand all the points in there. I don't know crap about the law, except you're not supposed to break it." Martin grinned at that one. "Not a bad place to start when you think about it." He didn't have to go any further. Not every occupant of this office had thought of things quite that way. Both men knew it, but it wasn't the sort of thing one said to the sitting president. "I know the things I don't like. I know the things I'd like to see changed. But God damn it," Ryan looked up, eyes wide now, "do I have the right to make that sort of call?" "Yes, Mr. President, you do. Because the Senate has to look over your shoulder, remember? Maybe they'll disagree on one or two. All these judges have been checked out by the FBI. They're all honest. They're all smart. None of them ever wanted or expected to make it to the Supreme Court except through a certiorari grant. If you can't come up with 9 you like, we'll search some more. Better then if you have somebody else do it. The head of the Civil Rights Division is also a pretty good man. He's off to my left some, but he's another thinker. Civil rights, Jack thought. Did he have to make government policy on that, too? How was he supposed to know what might be the right way to treat people who might or might not be a little different from everybody else? Sooner or later you lost the ability to be objective, and then your beliefs took over. And were you then making policy based on personal prejudice? How were you supposed to know what was right? Jesus. Ryan took a last puff and stubbed the cigarette out, rewarded as always by a dizzying buzz from the renewed vice. Well, I guess I have a lot of reading to do. I'd offer you some help, but probably better that you try to do it yourself. That way nobody pollutes the process. More than I've already done, that is. You want to keep that in mind. I might not be the best guy for this, but you ask me, and that's the best I have. I suppose that's all any of us can do, eh? Ryan observed, staring at the pile of folders. The chief of the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice was a political appointee dating back to President Fowler. Formerly a corporate lawyer and lobbyist, it paid far better than the academic post he'd held before his first political appointment. He'd been politically active since before his admission to law school. And as with so many occupants of official offices, he had become, if not his post, then his vision of it. He had a constituency, even though he'd never been elected to anything, and even though his government service had been intermittent, a series of increasingly high posts made possible by his proximity to the power that rested in this city, the power lunches, the parties, the office visits made while representing people he might or might not really care about, because a lawyer had an obligation to serve the interests of his clients. And the clients chose him, not the reverse. One often needed the fees of the few to serve the needs of the many, which was, in fact, his own philosophy of government. Thus he'd unknowingly come to live Ben Jonson's dictum about speaking to mere contraries, yet all be law. But he'd never lost his passion for civil rights, and he'd never lobbied for anything contrary to that core belief. Of course, nobody since the 1960s had lobbied against civil rights per se, but he told himself that was important. A white man with stock originating well before the Revolutionary War, he spoke at all the right forums, and from that he'd earned the admiration of people whose political views were the same as his. From that admiration came power. And it was hard to say which aspect of his life influenced the other more. Because of his early work in the Justice Department, he'd won the attention of political figures. Because he'd done that work with skill, he'd also earned the attention of a powerful Washington law firm. Leaving the government to enter that firm, he'd used his political contacts to practice his profession more effectively. And from that effectiveness, he'd generated additional credibility in the political world, one hand constantly washing the other until he couldn't really discern which hand was which. Along the way, the cases he argued had become his identity, in a process so gradual and seemingly so logical that he hardly knew what had taken place. He was what he'd argued for over the years. And that was the problem right now. He knew and admired Patrick Martin as a lesser legal talent who'd advanced at justice by working exclusively in the courts. Never even a proper United States attorney. Those were political appointments, mainly selected by senators for their home states. But rather one of the apolitical professional worker bees who did the real casework while their appointed boss worked on speeches, caseload management, and political ambition. And the fact of the matter was that Martin was a gifted legal tactician, 41 and one in his formal trials, better yet as a legal administrator guiding young prosecutors. But he didn't know much about politics, the civil rights chief thought, and for that reason he was the wrong man to advise President Ryan. He had the list. One of his people had helped Martin put it together, and his people were loyal, because they knew that the real path to advancement in this city was to move in and out as their chief had done. And their chief could, by lifting a phone, get them that job at a big firm. And so one of them handed his chief the list, with the names not redacted out. The chief of the Civil Rights Division had only to read off the 14 names. He didn't need to call up the paperwork on their cases. He knew them all. This one, at the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, had reversed a lower court ruling and written a lengthy opinion questioning the constitutionality of affirmative action. Too good a discourse. It had persuaded the Supreme Court in a sharply divided 5-4 decision. The case had been a narrow one, and the affirmation of it in Washington had been similarly narrow, but the chief didn't like any chips in that particular wall of stone. That one, in New York, had affirmed the government's position in another area, but in doing so had limited the applicability of the principle, and that case hadn't gone further and was law for a large part of the country. These were the wrong people. Their view of judicial power was too circumscribed. They deferred too much to Congress and the state legislatures. Pat Martin's view of law was different from his own. Martin didn't see that judges were supposed to write what was wrong. The two had often debated the issue over lunch in conversations spirited but always good-natured. Martin was a pleasant man, and a sufficiently good debater, that he was hard to move off any position, whether he was wrong or not. And while that made him a fine prosecutor, he just didn't have the temperament. He just didn't see the way things were supposed to be. And he'd picked judges the same way. And the Senate might be dumb enough to consent to the selections. And that couldn't happen. For this sort of power, you had to pick people who knew how to exercise it in the proper way. He really had no choice. He bundled the list into an envelope and tucked it into the pocket of his jacket and made a phone call for lunch with one of his many contacts. Chapter 30. Press. They did it for the morning news, so pervasive had become the influence of television. This was how reality was defined, changed, and announced. A new day had surely dawned. The viewer was left in little doubt. There was a new flag hanging behind the announcer, a green field, the color of Islam, with two small gold stars. He started off with an invocation from the Koran, and then went into political matters. There was a new country. It was called the United Islamic Republic. It would be comprised of the former nations of Iran and Iraq. The new nation would be guided by the Islamic principles of peace and brotherhood. There would be an elected parliament called a majlis. Elections, he promised, would be held by the end of the year. In the interim, there would be a revolutionary council comprised of political figures from both countries, in proportion to population. Which gave Iran the whip hand, the announcer didn't say. He didn't have to. There was no reason, he went on, for any other country to fear the UIR. The new nation proclaimed its goodwill for all Muslim nations, and all nations who had friendly relations with the former divided segments of the new land. That this statement was contradictory in numerous ways was not explored. The other Gulf nations, all of them Islamic, had not actually enjoyed friendly relations with either of the partners. The elimination of the former Iraqi weapons facilities would continue apace so that there would be no question of hostility to the international community. Political prisoners would be freed at once. And now they can make room for the new ones, Major Sabah observed at Palm Bowl. So, it's happened. He didn't have to phone anyone. The TV feed was being viewed all over the Gulf, and in every room with a functioning television the only happy face was the one on the screen. That is, until the scene changed to show spontaneous demonstrations at the various mosques, where people made their morning prayers and walked outside to display their joy. "Hello, Ali," Jack said. He'd stayed up reading the folders Martin had left, knowing that the call would come, suffering again from a headache that he seemed to acquire just from walking into the Oval Office. It was surprising that the Saudis had been so long in authorizing the call from their prince, minister without portfolio. Maybe they'd just hoped to wish it away, a characteristic not exactly unique to that part of the world. "Yes, I'm watching the TV now." At the bottom of the display, like the captioning for the hearing impaired, was a dialogue box being typed by intelligence specialists at the National Security Agency. The rhetoric was a little flowery, but the content was clear to everyone in the room. Adler, Vasco, and Goodley had come in as soon as the feed arrived, liberating Ryan from his reading, if not his headache. "This is very unsettling, if not especially surprising," the prince said over the encrypted line. There was no stopping it. "I know how it looks to you, Your Highness," the president said tiredly. He could have indulged in coffee, but he did want to get some sleep tonight. "We are going to place our military at a higher state of readiness." "Is there anything you want us to do?" Ryan asked. "For the moment, just to know that your support has not changed." "It hasn't. I've told you before. Our security commitment to the kingdom remains the same. If you want us to do something to demonstrate that, we're ready to take whatever steps seem reasonable and appropriate. Do you—" "No, Mr. President. We have no formal requests at this time." That statement was delivered in a tone that made Jack's eyes flicker off the speakerphone and to his visitors. "In that case, might I suggest that you have some of your people discuss options with some of mine?" "It must be kept quiet. My government has no wish to inflame the situation." "We'll do what we can. You can start talking to Admiral Jackson. He's J3 in the—" "Yes, Mr. President, I met him in the East Room. I will have our working-level people contact him later today." "Okay. If you need me, Ali, I'm always at the end of the phone." "Thank you, Jack. I hope you will sleep well." "You'll need it. We all will." And the line went dead. Ryan killed the button on the phone to make sure. "Opinions?" "Ali wants us to do something, but the king hasn't decided yet," Adler said. "They'll try to establish contacts with the UIR," Vasco took up the conversation. "Their first instinct will be to get a dialogue going, try to do a little business. The Saudis will take the lead. Figure Kuwait and the rest of the lesser states will let them handle the contacts, but we'll be hearing from them soon, probably through channels." "We have a good ambassador in Kuwait?" the president asked. "Wilbach," Adler said with an emphatic nod. "Career FSO, good man. Not real imaginative, but a good plugger, knows the language and culture, lots of friends in their royal family. Good commercial guy. He's been pretty effective as a middleman between our business people and their government." "Good deputy chief of mission to back him up," Vasco went on. "And the attachés there are tops, all spooks, good ones." "Okay, Bert." Ryan took off his reading glasses and rubbed his eyes. "Tell me what happens next." "The whole south side of the Gulf is scared shitless. This is their nightmare come true." Ryan nodded and shifted his gaze. "Ben, I want CIA's assessment of the UIR's intentions, and I want you to call Robbie and see what kind of options we have. Get Tony Brattano into the loop. He wanted to be SecDef, and I want him to start thinking about the non-admin part of the job." "Langley doesn't have much of a clue," Adler pointed out. "Not their fault, but that's how it is." And so their assessment would present a range of potential options, from theater nuclear war — Iran might have nukes after all — to the Second Coming, and three or four options in between, each with its theoretical justification. That way, as usual, the president had the chance to choose the wrong one, and it wouldn't be anyone's fault but his own. "Yeah, I know. Scott, let's see if we can establish some contacts with the UIR, too." "Extend the olive branch?" "You got it," the president agreed. Everyone figure they need time to consolidate before they do anything radical? There were nods with the president's assessment, but not from everyone.
Mr. President, Vasco said.
Yeah, Bert.
By the way, good call. You weren't exactly right on timing, but damned if you weren't right enough.
Thanks. Mr. President, on the consolidation issue, that's about people, right?
Sure.
Ryan and the rest nodded.
Consolidating a government meant little more than that the people got used to the new system of rule and accepted it.
Sir, if you look at the number of people in Iraq who have to get used to this new government, compare that number to the population of the Gulf states. It's a big jump in terms of distance and territory, but not in terms of population, Vasco said, reminding them that although Saudi Arabia was larger than all of America east of the Mississippi, it had fewer people than the Philadelphia metropolitan area.
They're not going to do anything right away, Adler objected.
They might. Depends on what you mean by right away, Mr. Secretary.
Iran has too many internal problems, Goodley started to say.
Vasco had come to like presidential access and attention, and decided to seize the floor.
Don't underestimate the religious dimension, he warned. That is a unifying factor which could erase or at least suppress their internal problems. Their flag says it. The name of the country says it. People all over the world like a winner. Darii sure looks like a winner now, doesn't he?
One other thing.
What's that, Bert? Adler asked.
You notice the flag? The two stars are pretty small, Vasco said pensively.
So?
This was Goodley. Ryan looked back at the TV and the announcer. The flag was still there behind him, and...
So there's plenty of room for more.
It was a moment such as he had dreamed of, but the culmination of such a dream is always better than its contemplation, because now the cheers were real, striking his ears from the outside, not the inside. Mahmud Haji Darii had flown in before dawn, and with the rising of the sun, he'd walked into the central mosque, removing his shoes, washing his hands and forearms, because a man was supposed to be clean before his God. Humbly he'd listened to the incantation from the minaret, calling the faithful to prayer. And this day people didn't roll back over and try to capture a few more hours of sleep. Today they flocked to the mosque from blocks around in a gesture of devotion that moved their visitor to his core. Darii took no special place, but he appreciated the singularity of the moment, and tears streamed down his dark, deeply lined cheeks at the overwhelming emotion of the moment. He had fulfilled the first of his tasks. He had fulfilled the wishes of the Prophet Muhammad. He had restored a measure of unity to the faith, the first step in his holy quest. In the reverent hush following the conclusion of morning prayers, he rose and walked out into the street, and there he was recognized. To the despairing panic of his security guards, he walked along the street, returning the greetings of people, at first stupefied, and then ecstatic to see the former enemy of their country walking among them as a guest. There were no cameras to record this. This was not a moment to be polluted by publicity. And though there was danger, he accepted it. What he was doing would tell him much. It would tell him of the power of his faith, and the renewed faith of these people. And it would tell him whether or not he had Allah's blessing on his quest. For Darii truly was a humble man, doing what he had to do, not for himself but for his God. Why else, he often asked himself, would he have chosen a life of danger and denial? Soon the sidewalk traffic turned into a crowd, and from a crowd to a mob. People he'd never met appointed themselves to be his guardians, forcing a path for him through the bodies and the cheers as his aged legs made their way, while his now serene dark eyes swept left and right, wondering if danger would come, but finding only joy that reflected his own. He gazed and gestured to the crowd as a grandfather might greet his progeny, not smiling, but composed, accepting their love and respect, and with his benign eyes promising greater things, because great deeds had to be followed by greater ones, and the moment was right.
"So, what sort of man is he?" movie star asked.
His flight to Frankfurt had been followed by one to Athens, and from there to Beirut, and from there to Tehran. He knew Daryai only by reputation.
"He knows power," Badrine answered, listening to the demonstrations outside.
There was something about peace, he imagined. The war between Iraq and Iran had lasted close to a decade. Children had been sent off to die. Rockets had blasted the cities of both countries. The human cost would never be fully assessed, and though the war had ended years before, now it was truly ended. A thing of the heart rather than of law, perhaps. Or maybe a thing of God's law, which was different from that of man. The resulting euphoria was something he'd once felt himself. But now he knew better. Feelings like that were weapons of statecraft, things to be used. Outside were people who, a short time before, had chafed at what they had and what they did not have, who questioned the wisdom of their leader, who bridled, as much as one could in so tightly controlled a society as this one was, at the freedoms they lacked. That was gone now, and it would remain gone for how long? That was the question, and that was why such moments had to be properly used. And Daryai knew all of those things.
"So," Badrine said, turning off the outside noise of the faithful, "what have you learned?"
"The most interesting things I learned from watching television. President Ryan is doing well, but he has difficulties. The government is not yet fully functional. The lower house of their parliament has not yet been replaced. The elections for that will begin to take place next month. Ryan is popular. The Americans love to poll one another," he explained. "They call people on the telephone and ask questions. Only a few thousand, often not that many. And from this they report to one another what everyone thinks."
"The result?" Badrine asked.
"A large majority seems to approve what he is doing. But he isn't really doing anything except to continue. He hasn't even chosen a vice president yet."
Badrine knew that, but not the reason.
"Why?" he asked.
Movie star grinned.
"I asked that question myself. The full parliament must approve such a thing, and the full parliament has not yet been re-established. It will not be so for some time. Moreover, there is the problem with the former vice president, that Keelty fellow who claims that he is the president, and this Ryan has not imprisoned him. Their legal system doesn't deal with treason effectively."
"And if we were able to kill Ryan?"
Movie star shook his head.
"Very difficult.
I took an afternoon to walk around Washington. Security at the palace is very strict. It is not open to public tours. The street in front of the building is closed. I sat on a bench for an hour reading and watched for signs around the place. Riflemen on all the buildings. I suppose we would have a chance on one of his official trips, but that would require extensive planning for which we lack the necessary time. And so that leaves us with..."
"His children," Badrine observed.
"Jesus, I hardly see them anymore," Jack thought. He'd just gotten off the elevator, accompanied by Jeff Raymond, and checked his watch. Just after midnight. Damn. He'd managed to sit through a hurried dinner with them and Kathy before hustling back downstairs for his reading and meetings, and now everyone was asleep. The upstairs corridor was a lonely place, too wide for the intimacy of a real home. Three agents were in view, standing post as they called it, and the warrant officer with the football full of its nuclear codes. It was quiet because of the time of night, and the overall impression was rather like that of an upscale funeral home, not a house with a family in it. No clutter, no toys lying on the rug, no empty glasses in front of a TV. Too neat, too tidy, too cold. Always somebody around. Raymond traded looks with the other agents, whose nods meant, "Okay, everything clear." Nobody with guns around, Ryan thought. Super. The bedrooms were too far apart up here. He turned left, heading for Katie's room first. Opening the door, he saw his youngest, recently graduated from crib to bed, lying on her side, a fuzzy brown teddy bear next to her. She still wore sleepers with feet on them. Jack could remember when Sally had worn the same, and how cute children looked that way, like little packages. But Sally now looked forward to the day she'd buy things from Victoria's Secret, and little Jack, he had taken to objecting to that label of late, now insisted on boxer shorts because that was the new in thing for boys of his age group, and they had to be pulled down low because the in thing was to risk having them fall off. Well, he still had a toddler. Jack approached the bed and stood there for a minute, just looking at Katie and quietly enjoying the status of fatherhood. He looked around, and again the room was unnaturally neat. Everything was picked up, not a loose item on the floor. Her clothing for the coming day was neatly laid out on a wooden valet. Even the white socks were folded next to the diminutive sneakers with cartoon animals on them. Was this a way for a child to live? It seemed like a Shirley Temple movie from when his mom and dad were kids, some upper-class thing that he'd always wondered about. Did people really live that way? Not real people, just royalty. And the family of the man sentenced to the presidency. Jack smiled, shook his head, and left the room. Agent Raymond closed the door for him, not even letting POTUS do that. Somewhere else in the building, Ryan was sure, an electronic status board showed that the door had been opened and closed. Probably sensors told that someone had entered the room, and probably someone had asked over the radio link the service people used to be told that Swordsman was tucking Sandbox in. He stuck his head in Sally's room. His elder daughter was similarly asleep, doubtless dreaming of some boy or other in her class. Kenny or something, wasn't it? Somebody who was way cool. Little Jack's bedroom floor was actually polluted by the presence of a comic book. But his white shirt was pressed and hanging on another valet, and someone had shined his shoes. Another day shot to hell, the president thought. He turned to his bodyguard. Night, Jeff. Good night, sir, Agent Raymond said outside the door to the master bedroom. Ryan nodded his farewell to the man, and Raymond waited for the door to shut. Then he looked left and right at the other detail agents. His right hand brushed against the service pistol under his jacket, and his eyes smiled in a private way, knowing what might so easily have been. Word had not come back. Well, his contact was doubtless being careful, as well he should. Arif Raymond had the duty tonight as supervisor for the detail. He walked up the corridor, nodding to the agents on post, asked one innocuous question, then headed down the elevator to the state floor, and outside to get some air, stretch, and look at the perimeter guard posts, where also everything was quiet. There were some protesters in Lafayette Park across the street, this time of night huddled together, many of them smoking. Exactly what he didn't know, but had suspicions. Maybe hashish, he wondered with a cryptic smile. Wouldn't that be funny? Beyond that, there were only the traffic sounds, a distant siren to the east, and people standing at their posts, trying to stay alert by talking about basketball, or hockey, or spring training for baseball, eyes sweeping outward, looking for dangers in the shadows of the city. The wrong place to look, Raymond thought, turning back to head for the command post.
Is it possible to kidnap them?
The two older ones, no, too inconvenient, too difficult. But the youngest, that is possible. It could be both dangerous and costly, movie star warned. Badrine nodded. That meant picking especially reliable people. Daryai had such people. That was obvious from what had taken place in Iraq. He looked over the diagrams in silence for a few minutes while his guest stood to look out the window. The demonstration was still underway. Now they were shouting, "Death to America!" The crowds and the cheerleaders who organized them had long experience with that particular mantra. Then his intelligence man came back.
"What exactly," movie star asked, "is the mission, Ali?"
The strategic mission would be to prevent America from interfering with us.
Badrine looked up. Us now meant whatever Daryai wanted it to mean.
All nine of them, Moody saw. He ran the antibody tests himself. He actually did each three times, and the tests were all positive. Every one of them was infected. For the sake of security, they were given drugs and told that they'd be all right, as they would until it was determined that the disease had been transmitted in its full virulence, not attenuated by reproduction in the previous set of hosts. Mainly they were dosed with morphine, the better to keep them quiet and stuporous. So first Benedict Macusa, then Sister Jean-Baptiste, then 10 criminals, and now 9 more. 22 victims, if one also counted Sister Maria Magdalena. He wondered if Jean-Baptiste was still praying for him in paradise, and shook his head.
So Hyla, Dr. MacGregor thought, looking over his notes. She was ill, but she had stabilized. Her temperature had abated a whole degree. She was occasionally alert. He'd thought jet lag at first until there had been blood in her vomit and stool. But that had stopped. Food poisoning? That had seemed the likely diagnosis. She'd probably eaten the same things as the rest of her family, but it could have been one bad piece of meat, or maybe she'd done what every child did, and swallowed the wrong thing. It happened literally every week in every doctor's office in the world, and was particularly common among the Western community in Khartoum. But she was from Iraq, too, just as patient Saleh was. He'd rerun the antibody tests on the latter, and there was no doubt. The bodyguard fellow was gravely ill, and unless his immune system rallied itself. Children, MacGregor remembered, somewhat startled by the connection, have powerful immune systems, rather more so than adults had. Though every parent knew that every child could come down with a disease and high fever in a matter of hours, the reason was simply that children, as they grew, were exposed to all manner of ailments for the first time. Each organism attacked the child, and in each child the immune system fought back, generating antibodies which would forever defeat that particular enemy, measles, mumps, and all the rest, whenever it again appeared, and rapidly defeating it the first time in nearly all cases, which was why a child could spike a high fever one day and be out playing the next, another characteristic of childhood that first terrified and then vexed parents. The so-called childhood diseases were those defeated in childhood. An adult exposed to them for the first time was in far greater distress. Mumps could render a healthy man impotent. Chicken pox, a childhood annoyance, could kill adults. Measles had killed off whole peoples. Why? Because for all its apparent frailty, the human child was one of the toughest organisms known to exist. Vaccines for the childhood diseases had been developed not to save the many, but the few who, for whatever reason, probably genetic, but that was still being investigated, were unusually vulnerable. Even polio, a devastating neuromuscular disease, had done permanent harm to only a fraction of its victims. But they were mostly children, and adults protected children with a ferocity usually associated with the animal kingdom. And properly so, MacGregor thought, because the human psyche was programmed to be solicitous to children. Which was why so much scientific effort had been devoted to childhood disease over the years. Where was this line of thought taking him, the doctor wondered. So often his brain went off on its own, as though wandering in a library of thoughts, searching for the right reference, the right connection. Saleh had come from Iraq. So Hyla had also come from Iraq. Saleh had Ebola. So Hyla showed symptoms of flu or food poisoning or... But Ebola initially presented itself as flu. My God, MacGregor breathed. He rose from his desk and his notes and walked to her room. Along the way he got a syringe and some vacuum tubes. There was the usual whining from the child about a needle, but MacGregor had a good touch, and it was all over before she was able to start crying, which problem he left to her mother,
who'd slept overnight in the room.
"Why didn't I run this test before?" the young doctor raged at himself. "Damn!"
"They are not officially here," the foreign ministry official told the health department official. "What exactly is the problem?"
"He seems to have Ebola virus."
That got the other man's attention. His eyes blinked hard, and he leaned forward across his desk.
"Are you certain?"
"Quite," the Sudanese physician confirmed with a nod. "I've seen the test data. The doctor on the case is Ian McGregor, one of our British visitors. He's actually a fine practitioner."
"Has anyone been told?"
"No."
The doctor shook his head emphatically.
"There is no cause to panic. The patient is fully isolated. The hospital staff know their business. We are supposed to make the proper notifications to the World Health Organization, informing them of the case, and..."
"You are certain there is no risk of an epidemic?"
"None.
As I said, full isolation procedures are in place. Ebola is a dangerous disease, but we know how to deal with it," the physician answered confidently.
"Then why must you notify the WHO?"
"In these cases, they dispatch a team to oversee the situation, to advise on procedures, and to look for the focal source of the infection so that..."
"This Saleh chap, he didn't catch the disease here, did he?"
"Certainly not. If we had that problem here, I would know of it straight away," he assured his host.
"So there is no danger of spreading the disease, and he brought it in with him, so there is no question that there is a public health danger to our country?"
"Correct."
"I see." The official turned to look out the window. The presence of the former Iraqi officers in Sudan was still a secret, and it was in his country's interest to make sure it stayed that way. Keeping secrets meant keeping secrets from everyone. He turned back.
"You will not notify the World Health Organization. If the presence of this Iraqi in our country became widely known, it would be a diplomatic embarrassment for us."
"That might be a problem. Dr. McGregor is young and idealistic, and..."
"You tell him.
If he objects, I will have someone else speak to him," the official said, with a raised eyebrow.
Such warnings, properly delivered, rarely failed to get someone's attention.
"As you wish."
"Will this Saleh fellow survive?"
"Probably not. The mortality rate is roughly 8 of 10, and his symptoms are advancing rapidly."
"Any idea how he contracted the disease?"
"None.
He denies ever having been in Africa before, but such people do not always speak the truth. I can speak with him further."
"That would be useful."
"President eyes conservatives for the Supreme Court," the headline ran. The White House staff never sleeps, though this privilege is occasionally granted to POTUS. Copies of various papers arrived while the rest of the city slept, and staff workers would take one of the copies and scan it for items of particular interest to the government. Those stories would be clipped, pasted together, and photocopied for the Early Bird, an informal publication which allowed the powerful to find out what was happening, or at least what the press thought was happening, which was sometimes true, sometimes false, and mainly in between.
"We got a major leak," one of them said, using an X-Acto knife to cut out the story from the Washington Post.
"Looks like it. Looks like it gets around, too," her counterpart on the Times agreed.
An internal Justice Department document lists the judges being reviewed by the Ryan administration for possible nomination to fill the 9 vacant seats on the Supreme Court. Each of the jurists listed is a senior appeals court judge. The list is a highly conservative roster. Not a single judicial appointee from Presidents Fowler or Durling is to be found on it. Ordinarily, such nominees are first submitted to a committee of the American Bar Association. But in this case, the list was prepared internally by senior career officials at the Justice Department, overseen by Patrick J. Martin, a career prosecutor and chief of the criminal division.
"The press doesn't like this."
"Think that's bad. Check this editorial out. Boy, they really responded fast to this one."
They'd never worked so hard on anything. The mission had turned into 16-hour days, not much beer in the evenings, hasty, pre-cooked meals, and only a radio for entertainment. That had to be played loud at the moment. They had lead boiling. The rig was the same as that used by plumbers, a propane tank with a burner on top, like an inverted rocket being static-tested. And atop that was a metal pot filled with lead kept in a liquid state by the roaring flame. A ladle came with the pot, and this was dipped, then poured into bullet molds. The latter were 58 caliber, 505 grain, made for muzzle-loading rifles, rather like what the original mountain men had carried west back in the 1820s. These had been ordered from catalogs. There were 10 of the molds, with 4 cavities per mold. So far, Ernie Brown thought, things were going well, especially on the security side. Fertilizer was not a controlled substance. Neither was diesel fuel. Neither was lead. And every purchase had been made at more than one place, so that no single acquisition was so large as to cause comment. It was still time-consuming menial labor, but, as Pete had remarked, Jim Bridger hadn't come west by helicopter. No, he'd traveled the distance on horseback, doubtless with a pack horse or two, making maybe 15 or 20 miles per day, then trapping his beaver one at a time, doing everything the hard way, the individual way, occasionally bumping into another of his kind and trading for jugged liquor or tobacco. So what they did was in the tradition of their kind. That was important. The timing worked out nicely. Pete was doing the ladle work now, and from the time he poured into the first mold set until he poured the last, the first set hardened enough that, when dipped in water and opened, the two-piece tool was like a pair of pliers, the mini-ball-type projectiles were fully formed and solid. These were tossed into an empty oil drum and the molds replaced in their holders. Ernie collected the spilled lead and dumped it back in the pot so that none would be wasted. The only hard part was getting the cement truck, but a search of local papers had found an auction sale for a contractor going out of business. And for a mere $21,000, they'd acquired a 3-year-old vehicle with a Mack truck body. Only 70,567.1 miles on the odometer, and in pretty good running shape. They'd driven that down at night, of course, and it was now parked in the barn, sitting 20 feet away, its headlights watching them like a pair of eyes. The work was menial and repetitive, but even that helped. Hanging on the barn wall was a map of downtown Washington, and as Ernie stirred the lead, he turned to look at it, his brain churning over the flat paper image and his own mental picture. He knew all the distances, and distance was the prime factor. The Secret Service thought it was pretty smart. They'd closed off Pennsylvania Avenue for the very purpose of keeping bombs away from the president's house. Well, hell, weren't they smart? They'd overlooked only one little thing.
"But I have to," McGregor said. "We are required to."
"We'll not," the health department official told him. "It is not necessary. The index patient brought the disease with him. You have initiated proper containment procedures. The staff are doing their job. You trained them well, Ian," he added to assuage the heat of the moment. "It would be inconvenient for my country for this word to go out. I discussed it with the Foreign Ministry, and word will not go out. Is that clear?"
"But if you pursue this, we will have to ask you to leave the country."
McGregor flushed. He had a pale northern complexion, and his face too easily showed his emotional state. This bastard could and would make another telephone call, and he would have a policeman, so they called them here, though they were decidedly not the civilized, friendly sort he'd known in Edinburgh, come to his house to tell him to pack his things for the ride to the airport. It had happened before to a Londoner who'd lectured a government official a little too harshly about AIDS dangers. And if he left, he'd be leaving patients behind. And that was his vulnerability, as the official knew, and as McGregor knew that he knew. Young and dedicated, he looked after his patients as a doctor should. And leaving them to another's care wasn't something he could do easily. Not here.
not when there were just too few really competent physicians for the patient load.
How is patient Sally?
I doubt he will survive.
That is unfortunate, but it cannot be helped. Do we have any idea how this man was exposed to the disease?
The younger man flushed again.
No, and that's the point.
I will speak to him myself.
Bloody hard thing to do from 3 meters away, MacGregor thought. But he had other things to think about.
So Hyla had tested positive for antibodies also. But the little girl was getting better. Her temperature was down another half a degree. She'd stopped her GI bleeding. MacGregor had rerun a number of tests and baselined others. Patient Sohaila's liver function was nearly normal. He was certain she'd survive. Somehow she'd been exposed to Ebola, and somehow she'd defeated it. But without knowing the former, he could only guess at the reason for the latter. Part of him wondered if Sohaila and Saleh had been exposed in the same way. No, not exactly. As formidable as a child's immune defenses were, they were not all that much more powerful than a healthy adult's, and Saleh showed no underlying health problems. But the adult was surely dying while the child was going to live. Why? What other factors had entered into the two cases? There was no Ebola outbreak in Iraq. There had never been such a thing, and in a populous country like that, didn't Iraq have a bio-war program? Could they have had an outbreak and hushed it up? But no, the government of that country was in turmoil. So said the Sky News service he had at his apartment, and in such circumstances, secrets like this could not be kept. There would be panic. MacGregor was a doctor, not a detective. The physicians who could do both worked for the World Health Organization, at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, and at CDC in America. Not so much brighter than he, as more experienced and differently trained. So Hyla. He had to manage her case, keep checking her blood. Could she still infect others? MacGregor had to check the literature on that. All he knew for sure was that one immune system was losing and another was winning. If he were to figure anything out, he had to stay on the case. Maybe later he could get the word out, but he had to stay here to accomplish anything.
Besides, before telling anyone, he had gotten the blood samples out to Pasteur and CDC. This strutting bureaucrat didn't know that, and the phone calls, if they came, would come to this hospital and to MacGregor. He could get some word out. He could tell them what the political problem was. He could ask some questions and relay others. He had to submit.
"As you wish, doctor," he told the official. "You will, of course, follow the necessary procedures."
Chapter 31 Ripples and Waves. The payoff was this morning, and again President Ryan suffered through the ordeal of makeup and hairspray.
"We should at least have a proper barber chair," Jack observed while Mrs. Abbott did her duty.
He'd just learned the day before that the presidential barber came to the Oval Office and did his job at the president's swivel chair. That must be a real treat for the Secret Service, he thought, having a man with scissors and a straight razor an inch from his carotid artery.
"Okay, Arnie, what do I do with Mr. Donner?"
"Number one, he asks any question he wants. That means you have to think about the answers."
"I do try, Arnie," Ryan observed with a frown.
"Emphasize the fact that you're a citizen and not a politician. It might not matter to Donner, but it will matter to the people who watch the interview tonight," Van Damme advised. "Expect a hit on the court thing."
"Who leaked that?" Ryan demanded crossly.
"We'll never know, and trying to find out only makes you look like Nixon."
"Why is it that no matter what I do, somebody—"
"Damn," Ryan sighed as Mary Abbott finished with his hair. "I told George Winston that, didn't I?"
"You're learning. If you help some little old lady to cross the street, some feminist will say that it was condescending. If you don't help her, the AARP will say you're insensitive to the needs of the elderly. Throw in every other interest group there is. They all have agendas, Jack, and those agendas are a lot more important to them than you are. The idea is to offend as few people as possible. That's different from offending nobody. Trying to do that offends everybody, the chief of staff explained. Ryan's eyes went wide. I got it. I'll say something to piss everybody off, and then they'll all love me. Arnie wasn't buying. And every joke you tell will piss somebody off. Why? Humor is always cruel to someone, and some people just don't have a sense of humor to begin with. In other words, there's people out there who want to get mad at something, and I'm the highest profile target. You're learning, the chief of staff observed with a grim nod. He was worried about this one.
We have maritime prepositioning ships at Diego Garcia, Jackson said, touching the proper point on the map.
How much is there? Brittano asked.
We just reconfigured the TOE.
What's that? SecDef asked.
A table of organization and equipment. General Michael Moore was the Army's chief of staff. He'd commanded a brigade of the 1st Armored Division in the Persian Gulf War. The loadout is enough for a little better than a brigade, a full-sized heavy army brigade, along with all the consumables they need for a month's combat operations. Added to that, we have some units set in Saudi Arabia. The equipment is almost all new, M1A2 main battle tanks, Bradleys, MLRs. The new artillery tracks will be shipped out in 3 months. The Saudis, he added, have been helping on the funding side. Some of the equipment is technically theirs, supposedly reserve equipment for their army. But we maintain it, and all we have to do is fly our people over to roll it out of the warehouses.
Who would go first if they ask for help?
Depends, Jackson answered. Probably the first out would be an ACR, Armored Cavalry Regiment. In a real emergency, we'd airlift the personnel from the 10th ACR in the Negev Desert. That can be done in as little as a single day. For exercises, the 3rd ACR out of Texas or the 2nd out of Louisiana.
An ACR, Mr. Secretary, is a well-balanced brigade-sized formation. Lots of teeth, but not much tail.
It can take care of itself, and people will think twice before taking it on, Mickey Moore explained, adding, before they can deploy for a lengthy stay, however, they need a combat support battalion, supply and repair troops.
We still have a carrier in the Indian Ocean. She's at Diego now with the rest of the battle group to give the crews some shore leave, Jackson went on.
Which just about covered that atoll with sailors, but it was something. At least they could have a beer or two and stretch their legs and play softball.
We have an F-16 wing, well, most of one, in the Negev as well, as part of our commitment to Israeli security. That and the 10th Cav are pretty good. Their continuing mission is to train up the IDF, and it keeps them busy.
Soldiers love to train, Mr. Secretary. They'd rather do that than anything, General Moore added.
I need to get out and see some of this stuff, Brittano observed, soon as I get the budget thing worked out. The start of it, anyway. It sounds thin, gentlemen.
It is, sir, Jackson agreed. Not enough to fight a war, but probably enough to deter one, if it comes to that.
Will there be another war in the Persian Gulf? Tom Donner asked.
I see no reason to expect it, the president replied.
The hard part was controlling his voice. The answer was wary, but his words had to sound positive and reassuring. It was yet another form of lying, though telling the truth might change the equation. That was the nature of spin, a game so false and artificial that it became a kind of international reality. Saying what wasn't true in order to serve the truth. Churchill had said it once, in time of war truth was so precious as to need a bodyguard of lies.
But in peacetime?
But our relations with Iran and Iraq have not been friendly for some time.
The past is the past, Tom. Nobody can change it, but we can learn from it. There is no good reason for animosity between America and the countries in that region.
Why should we be enemies? The president asked rhetorically.
So will we be talking to the United Islamic Republic? Donner asked.
We are always willing to talk to people, especially in the interest